From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Tuesday edition, Coronavirus Task Force member Dr. Anthony Fauci testified before the Senate Health Committee today, where several senators pointed out his focus is just one side of the coin.
While I respect the need for caution, we are too often presented with a false dichotomy, either saving our economy or saving lives.
That was Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. Today's hearing was entitled COVID-19, Safely Getting Back to Work and School. A lot of the focus was on testing and the availability of a vaccine. Indiana Senator Mike Braun, a member of the committee, was there, and he'll be here in just a moment. And last week, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy announced the creation of a China task force in the wake of the coronavirus to counter the current and emerging threats from China. Congressman Andy Barr of Kentucky, a member of the task force, joins us with more detail. Also, a report from the United Nations is predicting that the economic fallout from the coronavirus may end up killing more people worldwide than the actual virus itself. And what are the prospects for the U.S. economy? Well, Dan Celia, president of Financial Issues at Stewardship Ministries, is here to talk about the U.S. economy and potential effect of the coronavirus. Most Americans see the economic threat and are now ready to open up society. But how strongly do they want to open up? And who is driving it among the American people? Scott Rasmussen is here with answers. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T Perkins. All right, the initial task of flattening the curve of the coronavirus looks to be moving to the rearview mirror. We've flattened the curve. We've made sure that we have the capacity in our healthcare facilities. And now more and more states are reopening. Today's Senate hearing entitled COVID-19, Safely Getting Back to Work and School, has a lot of people still asking, all right, what are the next steps? Well, joining me now to provide some insight into that question and today's hearing is Senator Mike Braun of Indiana, who serves as a member of the Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, great to be on the show.
All right, Senator, other than this being kind of a strange hearing where you had several people testifying by video and people in the room wearing masks and the public not allowed in, what was your major takeaway from today's hearing?
Well, I think you've heard most recently just a litany of testing. So I was real proud of my staff to dig into that to see were there any glitches? And, of course, it all gets blamed upon the White House. And out of the gate early, part of the reason I ran was to try to reform health care. We had 80 senators jump in with an idea to do that of a broken health care industry that never embraced telemedicine. None of the reforms that they need to embrace to lower their costs to make things more transparent. Of course, we won't get back to that until this is in the rearview mirror. But early on, and it started, I think, January 24th or so, that is when, between the CDC and the FDA, testing was thwarted simply because the CDC didn't want to look at the South Korean test. They wanted to do their own. Well, that one didn't work. And it was in early March by the time those two agencies kind of got their signals straight and basically gave the pharmaceutical industry and universities and the places that, in talking to several CEOs that run some of the pharmaceutical companies, they were chomping at the bits to do the testing, the therapeutics, and the vaccine. And I just thought it was not fair to constantly blame all that on the administration. He was dealing with the same thing that's beset healthcare for decades, an industry that's not quick on its feet in general, and agencies that oftentimes aid and abet, you know, that issue. So that gave me a little glimmer of hope now that that's out of the way. And when you're talking about like AstraZeneca and Oxford University, a million doses of a vaccine available in September, a lot different than the year to year and a half that was commonplace just a month and a half ago.
Yeah, I would actually say, Senator, when you look at that fact, which you laid out, which is not just in the healthcare field in government. It's pretty much systemic through government, that it is resistant to change. It's slow to move. I would suggest, looking at the numbers, that it was President Trump's leadership that broke through, leveraging the power of the private sector to accelerate this research and develop these innovative diagnostic tests. I mean, you look what the administration's done, $11 billion to the states to help testing. I mean, this is it's almost setting up competition of seeing who can do it best, which is it's a free market concept. Tends to work. It's worked for quite well for America. And then you look at the fact that, according to testimony in your committee today, by September, the U.S. will be able to produce and distribute and apply at least 40 to 50 million tests per month. That's pretty significant.
It is. And it also, when you listen to the people, the government doesn't make these tests. They should set the stage for it happening, and they actually thwarted it. And you talk to the people that are actually doing it, and pharmacies got a lot of issues in terms of how they distribute their products, back to reforming healthcare.
Right.
They do a pretty good job in the lab with a very tricky dynamic that takes so many years of research. And I think due to the president knowing how entrepreneurs work, knowing how you're going to get quicker results. Imagine had you had a president that was just going to be hand-in-hand with the FDA and CDC. We'd still be talking about getting out of the gate. So I think that's a difference. The fact that he takes a different style and approach to things does get him in trouble in some cases. Setting back here a couple of weeks ago when he, drifted at one of the hearings on and a lot of that, too, that's part of the style of being someone that looks at things differently. In this highly charged, heated environment, you get none of the benefits of that. You only get the negatives. And, of course, that's been the name of the game since he got elected back in 16. So this is different. It's created a great national anxiety. We've never seen it before. It has characteristics as a virus itself. Now we know that youth who have been totally passed over, there might be a small segment that might have a genetic predisposition that showed up recently. It's a tricky virus. But everything I am seeing, we are setting the stage for addressing it. You don't hear anything about PPE. You don't hear anything about ventilators. You don't hear anything about being under supplied with critical care beds. Those were the first three. We took care of them pretty quickly. Now it's testing, and you'll hear about that until we get them to where they're quick and reliable.
In fact, speaking of testing, the chairman of the committee, Lamar Alexander, who is self-quarantining because of a staff member who had, a staff member who was diagnosed as having coronavirus just to out of precautions, he was leading this hearing by video. He said all roads back to work and school run through testing, and that what our country has done so far in testing is impressive, but not nearly enough. I mean, how close are we to where we're at a comfortable level on the on our testing capabilities?
Nobody has that exact answer, but I think that we're ramping up to where that will occur. And all I can tell you, because it was dwelled upon so much over the last month to a month and a half, is where did we really have the issue? And it wasn't with the White House. It wasn't with the industry. It was with the regulatory agencies. So until you have tests fully available for any of the businesses that have had a flare-up, for any of the potential hotspots like schools, to where you can't thoroughly test and put an iron dome around caregivers in the trenches and elderly living centers, retirement homes, all that, Florida has shown they found out how to do something, and it's through the laboratory of states and how you do things differently, not through the one-size-fits-all that we've pretty well swamped the real economy with. And our real risk now is what we do going forward, because bankruptcies will be the next tragedy that occur. We're seeing a few of them already. If we don't get off this idea that we need a phase four, $3 trillion in nature. To me, that was the biggest pile of baloney I've ever seen coming out of Pelosi in the House. We will have this thing linger for a long time, yeah, just beyond its political impact, which she's doing it for, to where this thing will be more like 08 and 09 than it needs to be if we're smart on a restart going forward, take a little mitigated risk, do it state by state, county by county, get the feds out of the way, including the money that they're talking about, you know, in a package four.
Could not agree more. Senator Mike Braun, let me play a clip that really kind of highlights that tension that your colleague, Senator Tim Scott, brought up today, and many of you did. But I think he encapsulates it very well. Play the clip of Senator Tim Scott.
While I respect the need for caution, we are too often presented with a false dichotomy, either saving our economy or saving lives. We've seen the goalposts around flattening the curve move, and I think that's unfortunate. Because at the same time we're doing that, businesses have collapsed, mental and physical health have declined, depths of despair escalate, educational outcomes nosedive.
What the media is telling us to listen to are the medical experts. That's just one side of the coin. And I think that point was made very clear today in the hearing that, yeah, we respect Dr. Fauci, we respect the medical experts, but that's just one side of the coin of what we must consider.
No doubt about it. And Tim was to the right of me. Rand Paul was to the left of me. And if you listen to the three of us in terms of what's going to make sense from here forward, and I did like the fact that Rand Paul put Dr. Fauci a little bit on the spot, and I think you need to make that point. It would be so easy to continue that highly bureaucratic, one-size-fits-all. It would guarantee that we're going to take the economic patient and damn near kill it in the process, and that doesn't need to happen. So, yeah, Tim was right on. Rand Paul, I thought, did a good job. I called out the real reason testing hasn't gotten off as quickly as it should when the industry, and I liked it when Richard Burr asked Dr. Fauci, has the White House, as President Trump, ever gotten in the way of testing and doing it quickly? And he said, absolutely not. So,
One final question for you, Senator Mike Braun. I mean, you're a businessman. You come from this background of getting things done. I mean, the president, in my view, has gotten things done on this front. We were just talking about that. But it appears to me that the media is constantly trying to find fault with the president and his response to this.
No doubt about it. It's been the case since November of 2016. It started shortly after he was elected. I came in with a government shutdown, got into the impeachment saga, and then the coronavirus. And for the time I've been here, there's no doubt about that.
Senator Mike Braun, as always, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming on the show today and giving us more insight on today's Senate hearing.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, Senator Mike Braun of Indiana. All right, don't go away, because when we come back, Kentucky Congressman Andy Barr, a new member of the China Task Force, joins us to talk about what's in store for this task force that has been put together by the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. That's next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
As coronavirus restrictions begin to ease, many Americans are grappling with how to adapt to the changing times. The last few months have transformed how worshipers think about church and how they are fed spiritually. While many churches are conducting services through live streams, drive-in services, and other means, questions still remain. What practical steps can we take? Are current restrictions appropriate? Do these restrictions violate the Constitution or religious freedom protections? Family Research Council has a new publication discussing religious liberty issues and offering practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate as our country opens back up. Visit frc.org/churchguidelines to view this resource and learn more. As always, visit frc.org/church for our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website is tonyperkins.com. All right, late last week, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy announced the formation of a China task force. It was intended to be a bipartisan task force, but he said after delaying for more than a year, the Democrats have never put forward any candidates for the task force, so he launched it as a Republican-led task force. They will be looking at a broad range of China-related issues, including influence operations targeting the U.S., the economic threat to our government and allies, efforts to gain the technological advantage, and China's role in the origin and spread of COVID-19. Joining me now to talk more about this, one of the members of the task force, Congressman Andy Barr of Kentucky's 6th Congressional District. Congressman Barr, welcome to Washington Watch.
Good afternoon, Tony. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, you're absolutely welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. Obviously, we're still waiting to find out when the House is going to reconvene. But let's talk about the focus of this task force and why you actually kind of been leading out on this issue. Why do you think it is so important that Congress take this on right now?
Well, clearly, the Chinese Communist Party's malign activities have been growing over the past several years. They have global ambitions, and they represent a significant threat to Western values and the United States on a variety of issues, not just militarily. Their buildup of their Navy and their malign activities in the South China Sea, their hacking exercises and the in cyberspace, their ambitions in space, their economic espionage, the forced transfer of technology, the theft of intellectual property, malign investment in U.S. and Western companies. It's a pretty comprehensive list, but I think many Americans did not fully appreciate the threat that the Chinese Communist Party faces until this COVID-19 pandemic. And the more we hear about the origins of the pandemic and China's disinformation campaign and censorship that allowed and enabled this virus to spread, the more Americans appreciate that we need to change our posture towards China. I think Americans are particularly concerned when they hear about what China did after the virus escaped the borders of China and then they weaponized the supply chain against us. I think that really was an eye-opener for many Americans, and and it's altogether appropriate that Congress respond with recommendations on how to protect the American people in the future.
I do agree with you 100% that the American people now are looking at this much differently. You know, there was ambivalence, I think, toward China, you know, that, yeah, they provided cheap products that we could buy at Walmart. And I think some consumers like that. But now I think people are rethinking that. I mean, I've heard those conversations, people talking about not buying China goods made in China. So, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I've been saying on the program now for weeks that this is the opportunity to recalibrate that relationship with China. Let me ask you this question, Congressman Barr, because I've talked about what the focus will be. You've talked about that. But what do you hope will be the outcome of this task force? What's your main objective in terms of changing that policy and getting something done?
Well, I think there needs to be two fundamental goals of the task force. Number one, we need to make solid recommendations to Congress and to the executive branch, to the president, about tangible actions that we can take to hold China accountable for the origins and the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic so that it never happens again, and so that China is deterred from further negligence or intentional conduct like this that could allow something like this to happen to the human community. We knew 2 years ago, unfortunately, that the Wuhan Institute of Virology, that super laboratory in the Hubei province, had some major safety concerns because there were some sensitive but unclassified cables sent back to the State Department from officials at the U.S. Embassy that were so alarmed with what they saw that they needed to alert Washington, D.C. We need to take action to hold China accountable and, frankly, compensate the American people for the serious cost in loss of lives and in treasure that this has caused us. Obviously, our economy has taken a huge hit as a result of this. The second objective I think that we have to have is we need to, for the long run, we need to better prepare the United States for a long-run global competition with a China and a Chinese Communist Party that continues to engage in malign conduct, both militarily and in terms of the economy. And we need to look at this from a lot of different angles, but from the perspective of the Financial Services Committee, on which I serve, we need to look at a variety of tools, including the way in which we interact with international financial institutions, the way we use or could use sanctions against China, other vehicles that are available to us, like CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, to block malign investment by China and Chinese state-owned enterprises in Western companies to steal our technology and our intellectual property. So there's a lot to this, but clearly we need to make some serious recommendations about that, counter the Chinese threat.
Congressman Barr, I like that because I do believe it needs to be concrete, specific action steps, policy recommendations that can be taken by the administration and Congress. And I would go a step further, Congressman Barr. I think this should become an election issue in November, because in order to see these policies put in place, the Republicans have to be in charge of the Congress. And that's what it's going to take to address this. Then the American people need to vote on these types of issues come November.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's terribly regrettable that Democrat leaders have decided that the threat posed by China isn't important enough to actually put members on this task force. They're more interested in a second round of impeachment against President Trump. And I think that is dangerous for our country. We should all, as Americans, be patriots and to work together to counter the Chinese communist threat.
Well, Congressman Barr, we'll look forward to having you back on to talk about some of those recommendations as the task force gets underway.
Thank you, Tony.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us. All right, folks, don't go away. A United Nations report predicting that the economic fallout of the coronavirus could cause more deaths than the actual virus itself. What might be the impact on the United States? Dan Celia is here next.
We'll be right back.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back. I'm Tony Perkins, and you're listening to Washington Watch. The United Nations has released a report that has predicted that the economic fallout from the worldwide coronavirus outbreak may end up killing more people than the actual disease itself. The World Bank estimated that the coronavirus will likely cause the first increase in global poverty since 1998. Now, of course, the large portion of the world's population lives in extreme poverty. They're saying that up to 420 million people would be plunged into extreme poverty as a result of this. What impact might it have on the United States? Are we going to see a recession? If so, how long? Joining us now to talk about this is the president and CEO of Financial Issues at Stewardship Ministries, our good friend Dan Celia. Dan, welcome back.
Tony, it's great to be back with you.
All right, it's been really, I think, probably a month and a half, 2 months since we've talked about this. What's your take from on the economic issues of this virus and its impact upon the U.S. economy?
Well, certainly, Tony, the economic impact has gotten more and more fragile, and it continues to get more and more fragile every week. And certainly, President Trump understands that and knows that. Steve Mnuchin and others, Larry Kudlow, understand how critically important it is that we don't lose too much more ground in the economy, and that it's critically important that we start to open things up again. And I know there's a fine balance there, but the numbers that you just mentioned are numbers that I've talked about for some time. I'm still a consultant from back in 1987. I'm still on the list at the World Bank. And so I get all these reports as soon as they're coming out. When we see some of them, the numbers are extremely disturbing. And look, the poverty rate, the economic stature of America is going to forever change. And it's going to take really a long – the longer we go, the longer and longer it's going to take to get some sort of normalcy back. And I think the biggest problem that we face right now in the economy is really fear. So you've got workers that are concerned about getting back to work. And until we have some extremely widespread testing, or better yet, a treatment that can solve the problem if they do get it, it's going to be difficult for plants, factories to open up because the workers are just going to be too concerned. The other problem that nobody is talking about is the employers. So the employers' position right now are one of we're not going to be able to get out of from here to a running start into ramping up again. We have to take some time because they don't want to spend the resources they have, ramp up the economy only to see a resurgence of this. So without treatment, and obviously the silver bullet is the vaccine, but without those things, I know that companies are going to immediately get back to work as soon as they can, but they're not going to get back to work to the same level that they were working, not only because of obvious reasons, demand has to pick up and all that gradual consumer spending and those kinds of things have to happen, but I think it's going to be more that they're going to be fearful of bringing back a workforce without knowing that it's going to be sustainable.
So let me ask you about that. So in terms of sustainability, you're talking about maybe another wave of the virus where there could be shutdowns again?
Yes. And they're going to be concerned about that.
Right.
They kind of feel right now that that is probably going to happen.
Well, that's because the media is repeatedly saying that.
Exactly. So I think there is going to be a segment of that that is going to work through it. And hopefully that will bring once the big companies that are sitting back waiting and watching, once they see that we're pushing through it and we're getting this done and it's not what the media is portraying it to be, then I think we'll get back on track relatively soon. But it's then going to be driven by consumers. So the fear from consumers has to be, wait a minute, I'm not going to go work next to somebody that I don't know where they were last night. I have a concern with that. So there's going to be this fear that the media has done an unbelievable job in instilling into the average workman in America.
Right.
So I think that it is I believe about 3% of what I hear, but I'm very selective even at that of who I listen to. But that's going to be the issue.
Yeah.
Fear is going to be the biggest issue.
That has been the issue from the beginning. In fact, it's always been an issue, but the media plays on that. I mean, they play on that intentionally. Dan Celia, thanks so much. We're going to continue to stay in touch with you as things develop and hopefully as states reopen and businesses get back to work and churches go back into action and we begin to see communities return to normal. Dan Celia, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Tony.
All right. All right, folks, don't go away. Coming back, how bad do people want to go back to work? Scott Rasmussen has the answer here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
As coronavirus restrictions begin to ease, many Americans are grappling with how to adapt to the changing times. The last few months have transformed how worshipers think about church and how they are fed spiritually. While many churches are conducting services through live streams, drive-in services, and other means, questions still remain. What practical steps can we take? Are current restrictions appropriate? Do these restrictions violate the Constitution or religious freedom protections? Family Research Council has a new publication discussing religious liberty issues and offering practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate as our country opens back up. Visit frc.org/churchguidelines to view this resource and learn more. As always, visit frc.org/church for our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
You're listening to Washington Watch, and I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. The website is tonyperkins.com. All right, we were just talking with Dan Celia about the fear looming over the reopening of society when it comes to workers, comes to business owners. And it reminds me of FDR in his first inaugural address. Back in the Great Depression, I don't agree with everything he did, but he did do some good things. He had some good speeches. But one thing he said, and you'll recall this because it's a very famous quote, but only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And fear grips so many people. And I've seen this, and we've talked about it from day one of the coronavirus, is fear. And for believers, we can't operate out of fear. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7 says, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." This is a great opportunity for those who have confidence in the midst of this. And in our economy, the way the whole thing works, it's based on confidence, consumer confidence. You heard that term before? And if we shrink back in fear, afraid to go to work, afraid to go out of the house, which, quite frankly, that's the message the media has been hammering us with. Oh, but if you go out, there's going to be a second wave. You shouldn't start too soon because there's going to be a second wave. But here, I have confidence in the American people. And to prove that point, our good friend Scott Rasmussen, pollster publisher of ScottRasmussen.com, has a new survey which suggests the American people are not necessarily listening to the media. Joining us now is Scott himself. Scott, welcome back.
Tony, it's great to be with you. I've got to, I chuckled at your opening reference to FDR because, the very first policy decision he made, he gave great speeches and warned people not to be afraid. He wanted to try and build confidence and make people feel better. And the very first policy decision he did was to legalize beer at the end of Prohibition. He wanted to get people to think about something besides the economic crisis because more was going on in the nation.
Well, they would forget all their troubles.
That's right. You may not appreciate the policy step, but, he recognized it was something bigger than a simple question of the government fixing what had gone wrong. In our polling that you referenced, like everybody else, we find if you ask people, you know, has the government gone too far in locking things down or not far enough or whatever, very few people, only 23% in our poll, think government officials have gone too far. 71% say they've either not gone far enough or have found about the right balance. And so that leads to that commentary you mentioned. Oh, nobody wants to end the lockdowns. But it's always good to ask questions from a different perspective. And we said, should every business in America, every business, not the chosen few, not the essential ones, should every business be allowed to open if they establish appropriate social distancing protocols? 60% said yes. Only 26% said no. So a majority is saying we think every business that's behaving responsibly should be allowed to open right now. And that just throws an entirely different flavor on the discussion.
But that is what makes capitalism work, our free market system. You don't force people to go in and buy a loaf of bread. They feel comfortable in going into your establishment. And so it's up to you to draw the consumers in. And that's what makes our system work. And that's why it addresses the fear factor. But it does it in a way that it's not the government's not the one doing it. It's the business owner.
That's right. And there's something else that came out of this. Now, we looked at the details of the survey data, and we took a special look at the people who said they don't think the government has gone far enough at this point. And you know what? When we asked them, should every business be reopened if they adhere to these protocols, they're evenly divided. 39% said yes, 45% no. These are people who said the government hasn't gone far enough yet. But if you frame the question in terms of, you know, an appropriate behavior,
right,
they're split right down the middle. And I, and by the way, something else that's going on here in public dialogue, terminology sometimes gets confused. You know, a lockdown by the government is different than social distancing being practiced by individuals, but they've almost become the same thing in the media narrative. And voters still want safety and responsible behavior, but they just don't want the government lockdowns.
Now, the bottom line of what you found is that only one out of four voters today is opposed to letting all businesses reopen in a responsible manner. That one out of four, that's just 25%. So despite the media's harangue, their constant barrage of fear-mongering, the American people realize what we've got to do, and if the businesses, if the establishments that they go to are allowed to open, guided by, you know, good or best practices, they're ready for them to open.
They are. And look, there's different opinions about what are best practices. Is being 3 feet apart okay? Is being 6 feet apart? What happens when you sneeze? You know, what people are really looking for, again, is a sense of they don't want to just throw the doors open and pretend that nothing happened. We do have a serious virus, a serious contagion. Okay, we're adults. Let's deal with it and move on.
Right. And that's where I think I find it interesting. I don't know if you – I looked at your crosstabs, and it was more the demographics. I don't think it broke down. So, well, it did break it down, conservative party and ideology. I mean, I think those with a liberal orientation tend to – correct me if I'm wrong, but my perception is based on what I've been looking at, the kind of a 30,000-foot view, is that those from a liberal orientation lean more to the government being the problem solver as opposed to trusting the free markets and the business owners to be providing the protections.
Right. And, you know, let's, and I would put it in the context of civil society. You know, can people in their own decision making and behaviors as individuals, as nonprofits, as businesses, can they create something that is generally safe and reasonable, or does it have to be government regulation? You know, on the question of opening every business establishment, liberals are evenly divided. Conservatives strongly say yes. Again, consistent with that view. And there's something else going on in this whole process that I think is beginning to shift that's really important to note. 64% of voters say that if a government shuts down your business, if they've ordered a lockdown, they are responsible for covering the losses incurred by the owner as a result of the government action. There is a sense of, you know, there are limits to what a government can do, and governments must be held accountable. And I think this gets back to the same concept. Okay, if a decision was really important that had to be made to shut something down, that's great. But now let's figure out how to compensate those who made the sacrifice.
That's new, frankly. I mean, that's because I remember back when I was in an office, in holding office, and, you know, you have government taking actions that routinely impact business. For instance, I remember a situation where road improvements. So they shut down a major road to do the road improvements. It took about 6 months, and all the businesses there basically dried up. And, you know, legislation introduced to compensate those businesses, and that was, you know, roundly rejected. That was not the responsibility of government, even though they were negatively impacted by government action. So this is ushering in, I think, a much different understanding of the actions that government takes, its impact upon private businesses, and the financial responsibility that the government then has.
Yes, and I think, you know, to be fair, this is a very dramatic example. You know, if a government tells a restaurant they can't stay in business, there's no arguing about how much the road construction hurt the business. It clearly you have told them to stop. So I think it makes the point very clearly for most voters to understand.
It does, but it just, as we go forward, we're talking about, you know, the media is talking about a second wave and maybe having to do periodic rolling shutdowns. This could become very costly if this is the view going forward.
Absolutely. I think what we're going to is, we're probably going to end up with a significant level of government. Well, we already have had a significant level of government spending. The government is borrowing more money this quarter than they have in any other complete fiscal year before. So the spending is unimaginable compared to normal times. The only comparable we have is to World War II.
Right.
And at the end of World War II, we had a tremendous debt, more than double our national income, and we worked to pay it down over a generation or so to where it reached only 30% of our national income. I think we're going to be in a similar situation. The debt is going to explode. And then people can say, okay, now we got to work this off. And that's going to be the battle of a generation to pay for this pandemic and the shutdowns.
Scott Rasmussen, I want to ask you of this latest survey, if there are any surprises that you had from the data that you collected. But before you do that, I want to give you what surprised me. As I looked through the kind of the crosstabs, the breakdown, I was actually surprised that there was very little difference between the suburban voter, the urban voter, and the rural voter on the question that you put before them. I just kind of thought that was more those city dwellers would be more inclined to not go back to work, and it appears that it's pretty much across the board.
Right. You know, that surprised me at first, and that actually led to a lot of the analysis that we did, because you're absolutely right. Urban voters are far more likely to say we should continue the lockdowns. Rural voters far more likely to say end the lockdowns, let's get back to life. And I think, you know, that what we're seeing here is, again, a different understanding, a different perception of what the lockdowns mean. Those urban voters who are saying we want to keep the lockdowns, but we're okay with businesses reopening, are really saying we want to make sure in the densely populated area that we live in that some guidelines are in place when these restaurants reopen. If they do so responsibly, great. And in the rural areas, they're saying, you know, we don't have those same issues. Let's get to reopening.
Right. Well,
so
actually,
it's a terminology issue.
What the folks in New York are saying is, hey, we want to be like those folks down in Texas where we just got a little space between us. That's what we want.
Well, you know, we did a poll for justthenews.com that came out a couple of days ago that said that 42% of voters nationwide expect that places like New York City are going to lose a lot of population in the coming years because of this pandemic. And there's, you know, a reasonable chance that will happen.
All right, Scott, what surprised you most in this latest round of survey, this latest survey you did?
Well, you know, the questions that we've been talking about aren't really the ones that surprise me. I mean, I was at the same points you noticed on suburban versus urban and rural voters on that one question. But the bigger surprise came in the question about government compensation for businesses they shut down. And on that question, there was virtually no difference between Republicans, Democrats, and independents. I said it's one of the rare moments of political unity in American politics today.
Yeah, well, and it's understandable. It really is. I do have one more point I want you to speak to because it caught my eye. Other recent data that you've done shows that 65% of voters are concerned that public officials may be using the pandemic as an excuse to infringe upon constitutional rights of individual Americans. How strong is that sentiment out there?
Well, 39% of voters are very concerned about it. So that's a pretty significant issue. A few weeks ago, we found that just over half were concerned that government officials might use this to infringe upon religious liberty. So we focus specifically on that. I think that we're seeing right now a growing concern, partly because these lockdowns are continuing. It's not a 1 or 2 week situation. And of course, in this new question, the concern about civil liberties was framed more broadly than just religious liberty. So I think people are beginning to say, there's something uncomfortable about this process.
The longer it goes, the higher the concern becomes.
Right. And look, people understand that if there's a health emergency and a government has to act very quickly in an extreme emergency, certain things can be accepted, just like when a hurricane strikes. Certain actions are acceptable that are not the norm. But when you go beyond a week or two, you begin to say, are we really in that same crisis at this point?
Yeah, I put myself in that category as well. Scott Rasmussen, as always, great to have you on the program. Always very, very insightful to know what people are thinking.
Tom, it's great to be with you. Look forward to talking again.
All right. Have a great evening. Scott Rasmussen. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com, and you can follow the links over. This is actually encouraging to me because it does suggest that Americans across the board, conservative, liberal, independent, whatever, are ready to go back to work. There are concerns about the infringement on constitutional rights the longer these shutdowns are in place. I think it's time to go back to work. I think it's time for churches to meet again, all using safe social distancing protocols. I think we have to be responsible in that sense, but I think it's time to begin moving again. I'm very concerned about the long-term economic impact and what that's going to do to families, what that is going to do to communities. But do not fear, all right? Do not fear. Be anxious for nothing, but with prayer, supplication, with thanksgiving. Let your requests be made known unto God. All right, until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything that you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, you got it. Just keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.